Well, thanks for coming early on a Sunday morning to hear about the exciting topic of saving strategically. So we're ending our Sunday classes on a bang for the season.
Yes.
So, well, welcome. This is the last session number 4 of our class we're calling Stewarding Our Finances with Eternity in View. And our theme verse has been 1 Timothy 6:6, which says, "Now there is great gain in godliness with contentment." And I like how Brian reminded us that it's right to be motivated by gain. We're wired that way. God's made us that way. But we want to be motivated by godly gain, by the gain of God himself, ultimately. And our book for the class has been The Treasure Principle, subtitled Discovering the Secret of Joyful Giving. This is by Randy Alcorn. Highly recommend this. It's a short read. I read it this week, the other day for my quiet time, and it took me less than an hour, probably. It's good to have my heart dusted off when it comes to an eternal perspective on giving. I know I can get so accustomed just to going through the motions of putting my check in the basket or clicking a button online. But guys like Randy Alcorn, through the Word, help us remember that it's eternity that it's being affected, and that there are eternal rewards for giving in this life, which is amazing.
That's true.
So we're going to talk about saving today. And I made a couple qualifications last week in talking about planning that I want to repeat just for everyone's benefit. I want to clarify what we're not doing by emphasizing some of the more practical aspects of stewardship. So number one, we're going to get practical, but it's no less spiritual or biblical. You know, as Brian said, theology is meant to work itself out in actions and in our daily lives and in details. And so we're not moving from the spiritual to the secular. This is putting the Word into practice. It's doing the Word. And because God owns everything and we are stewards, financial activity, financial decisions are spiritual activity and spiritual decisions. And plus, we want to be doers of the Word. I'm going to suggest some ways to do the Word this morning. James 1:22 says, "But be doers of the Word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves." And of course, in everything, we want to be motivated by grace. It may be easy to be condemned or discouraged about how you've handled money in the past or how ill-equipped you feel. But it's all by grace, and there's nothing we can do to earn God's favor, deserve God's favor, pay back God for his favor. And so let's always work from that foundation. The other qualification, which I hope doesn't sound contradictory, is we're not emphasizing practices over principles. Principles are always more important than practices, and there's no one-size-fits-all way to do stewardship. There's a variety of ways to practice wise, faithful, scriptural stewardship. And I'll give an example so you know what I'm talking about. Last week we talked about budgeting, and I encourage you to give every dollar a name and track all your expenses and compare them to a budget and use a certain methodology. If you don't do that, you know, I certainly am not going to say you're not a faithful steward or you're somehow sinning or not being scriptural. I think we all need to have a plan of some sort, but I know people who are very faithful and exemplary students, and their plan is something like this. Give generously, 10% or more, save for short-term and long-term needs, and live off the rest without incurring any debt. And that works. So I think there's advantages to being more intentional and specific, and I'm going to talk about that, but hopefully you get the point. Just take what you can use and leave the rest. So. All right, saving strategically. There's a couple of verses on saving that I think are applicable. Proverbs 21:20, this is point number 3, says, "Precious treasure and oil are in a wise man's dwelling, but a foolish man devours it." So using up all we have and not setting anything aside is described as foolish. And in the book of Proverbs, you know, folly is set against wisdom as what we should avoid. Any Charles Dickens fans out there? We like Charles Dickens in our house. We've read them all or watched a movie version of just about everything he's written, probably. But one of my favorites is David Copperfield. And as is often true in Dickens stories, there's great reversals of fortune, and money is often a central theme. But people go from rags to riches and riches to rags regularly in his books. And David Copperfield is the most autobiographical of Dickens' novels. David Copperfield in the book works in a factory while his father was in a debtor's prison. And that was true for Charles Dickens himself. But there's this character named Wilkins Micawber, and something he said in the book has become known as the Micawber Principle. This is kind of a lovable character, but he's kind of got his head in the clouds. He's kind of happy-go-lucky, not worried about tomorrow. He spends more than he can afford to spend. He keeps thinking that something will turn up. Something's right around the corner that's going to reverse his finances. But before that happens, his debtors come to collect, and he can't pay, and he gets thrown in debtor's prison. And so David Copperfield goes to see him in the debtor's prison, and Wilkins Micawber says the following: annual income, 20 pounds. Annual expenditures, 19 pounds, 19 and 6. Result, happiness. Annual income, 20 pounds. Annual expenditure, 20 pounds, 0 and 6. Result, misery. So if you spend less than you earn, live within your means, and avoid debt, you can't get into trouble. And you're just asking for trouble and misery if you live beyond your means, even by a little bit in some cases. And the only way we can begin to save is to spend less than we earn and save the difference. So Proverbs 6:6-8 says, go to the ant, O sluggard, consider her ways and be wise. Without having any chief, officer, or ruler, she prepares her bread in summer and gathers her food in harvest. So even the ant, by instinct, knows that when there's a time of plenty, we need to gather and put something away for a time when there's scarcity. So number four, the secret to saving. You heard it here first. Sovereign Grace Church of Louisville. Spend less than you earn and save the difference. This George Orwell quote I like, he said, sometimes the first duty of intelligent men is the restatement of the obvious. So I think our priorities are giving first, then saving, and then spending, you know, in that order, assuming you're paying your debts and your taxes. One practical tip to help you save: when it's automatic, out of sight, out of mind, it works best. You know, automatic transfers, direct deposit, just have it come right off the top, or pay yourself first, you might say, helps a lot when it comes to saving. And we can't talk about saving without mentioning something to avoid, which is hoarding. And my definition of hoarding is excessive saving or accumulating with no goal or purpose. So just like in a budget, we give every dollar a name and give it a purpose or a mission as to how it's going to be spent. I think we need to define our savings in a similar way and give all our savings categories a name, give all our savings dollars a name. And so how much is too much? How do you know if you're hoarding? Well, I can't answer that. It really depends. But I think if, even with areas you may save a lot of money for, like retirement, if you've backed into some sort of calculation that says I need X dollars when I retire, and to accumulate that I need to save X dollars now, then it's reasonable and logical and not hoarding. Of course, you can always trust in your bank account balance or your 401k balance, whether it's 1,000 or 1,000,000. But as long as we have a reason, a purpose for what we're saving and guard our hearts, we can avoid hoarding. And that's not to say you can't accumulate a lot of money and legitimately for college or retirement or even 6 months worth of expenses as an emergency reserve is a chunk of change. So I divide savings into two main categories, short-term and long-term. So number five is short-term savings. And this would be money that you're going to need a few months from now to, say, 5 years from now. And these would be things like non-monthly expenses that we're going to talk about in a minute. Your emergency reserve would be in this category. You may be saving for a next car or for a down payment on a house. This is all money you want to keep liquid and keep in a savings account or a money market kind of account that's easily accessible and not at risk. So this is short-term savings. All right, we're going to talk about something called a holding account for non-monthly expenses. This is kind of a hybrid. It's partially savings. It's partially just managing your cash flow and your budget. But the categories that kill us in trying to manage a budget are not things like, you know, rent and mortgage and utilities, because they stay the same every month and we get accustomed to paying them. But what about the things that don't happen every month, that happen maybe once a year and it's a big chunk all at once? Or you know it's going to happen sometime, but you don't know exactly when, like a car repair. You know it's coming, but you're not sure exactly when. How do you handle those and plan for those? And those are the things that are just budget busters. So being proactive and planning for them and saving for them in advance, I think, is wise. It's worth the extra effort. You may look at this and say, Mark, you've got way too much time on your hands. How do you find the time to do all this tracking and accounting? And it may not be for you, but this is one investment of time that will pay off. All right, so how do we approach this non-monthly expense category? Well, if you own a home, you probably have a mortgage. And if you probably have a mortgage, you probably have a payment that has four parts. And so this is an analogy to illustrate this holding account that I'm working towards. But your monthly payment is typically made up of four parts. PITI is the acronym. The P is for principal. That's the original loan amount that you borrowed that you pay back to the mortgage company or bank. I is the interest. That's the cost of the money, just the price to borrow it, that you pay back to the mortgage company. But then there's two other things that are usually included that actually aren't ultimately belonging to the mortgage company. They belong to a government agency or an insurance company. So T is taxes. Those are real estate taxes. And they're paid to Jefferson County, Kentucky, or whatever county you might live in. But the mortgage company has a stake in your house. They have an interest because they hold the mortgage, and they want to make sure the taxes are paid. So they require you every month to pay it to them, and they set it aside in something called an escrow account so that once a year when the taxes are due, the money is there to pay the tax bill. And it's similar with insurance. You pay a monthly amount probably to the mortgage company. They eventually pass that on to the insurance company whenever the insurance bill is due, maybe once a year or twice a year. So the point is, if you own a home, you know how to do this concept already. You're somewhat familiar with it. And so I'm suggesting set up your own escrow account for certain other kinds of non-monthly expenses that are paid maybe once or twice a year. And I actually think it's worth setting up a separate bank account for this. I usually recommend a three bank account structure. It's a checking account for paying all your bills from, that you do all your budget tracking in also. And then a savings account for the holding account. And then a third savings account for your emergency reserve and other short-term goals you're saving for. PNC Bank, although I don't use them, I'm not recommending them, they offer this exact structure. They offer a spending account, a reserve account, and a growth account, is I think what they call it. So, all right, we'll turn the page to this holding account sheet. I want to show you what this holding account tracking looks like and how you manage it and how it can help you. So you need to decide which budget categories you want to handle this way that are, you know, non-monthly expenses. And these are just the big ones. You want to keep it simple. You don't want to do this for small dollar amounts. But in this example, you know, this person has decided that there's four categories they want to be saving for on a monthly basis: auto repairs, Christmas, travel, and homeschooling. And so you'll arrive at a monthly budget for each of those. It's $350 a month for those categories. And on June 30th, you know, you have to start somewhere. So you have to fund this account initially from some other source. Scrape it together somehow or build it up slowly over time. But let's say this person has saved an extra $1,000 and that's what they're kicking off their holding account with. And then as bills come due in these four categories, they would transfer the money from the holding account back to the checking account and pay the bill. I know it sounds like a lot of extra work and transferring, but I think it helps keep it straight. And then every paycheck, they'd be putting, you know, half of the monthly amount into the holding account. And I personally do this by a direct deposit. I just have it go straight into my holding account from my paycheck for the non-monthly expenses I'm choosing to fund this way. And so some months, the only thing that'll happen is my deposit will go in there and I won't have any expenses in auto repairs, Christmas gifts, travel, or homeschooling. But I'll tell you, it's a great feeling when Christmas rolls around or it's time to buy curriculum for the homeschool year and the money's just sitting there waiting for you in the account. Feels really good. So this is a suggestion. It works. I'll put this spreadsheet online so you can use it if you like, but hopefully you get the concept. All right, let's move on to longer-term investing. And I want to try to motivate you by talking about the time value of money or the accumulative effect of compounding gains. And I love Proverbs 13:11. Wealth gained hastily will dwindle, but whoever gathers little by little will increase it. I think that's the best way to gain wealth, little by little. Sudden wealth can be a curse. So let's see. So look at this table here. Y'all have that table in your, that one? Good. So here's the example. If a person at age 30 makes a $1,000 deposit each year for 35 years and earns an average of 8% each year, they will have saved the following. So if you go down to the 8% row and across to the 35-year column, that will have turned into $172,317. Now, all they invested was $1,000 a year for 35 years, so that's $35,000. So all the rest is growth and gains and compounding interest. And let's say they had started 5 years earlier and had invested that $1,000 a year for 40 years. Look at the number to the right of the arrow. It would have jumped to $259,027. Again, all they put in was 40, so $220,000 is gains and growth and compounding interest over the years. So it's a powerful thing. But you see all the growth happens in the later years. But to experience the later years, you have to start early. That's the catch, of course. So, and you may say, well, where am I going to get 8%? You can't find that. Well, I mean, we're going to talk about stocks and bonds and mutual funds shortly, but just as an indication, the S&P 500 index, the Standard & Poor's 500, which is a stock index of the 500 largest companies in America, it's averaged 11% for the last 40 years. So if you'd invested $1,000 a year, starting 40 years ago, you'd have something like $600,000 today. So that's real money. It's not made up. If I had done that at the time, which I wish I had, I'd have $600,000 right now. So. But again, that's the key. You have to start early to take advantage of the later years. So that's my encouragement to you, especially if you're young, is start early, even if it's a small amount. I think one of my bigger mistakes financially is not saving earlier. So. All right, so long-term savings I define as 5 years to say 40 years, and you know, this is college education for the kids. Maybe you want to save for a wedding for a daughter, or retirement is the big one. But college is a big one too. You know, we had a conviction just to avoid student loan debt for our girls, and by the grace of God and through saving and scholarships and some help from grandparents, they're going to finish debt-free, which I'm so grateful for. And you've earned it, girls. So, yeah, just for the University of Louisville here, it's $20,000 a year for in-state tuition, room, board, and books. That's $80,000 for 4 years. If you have two kids, that's $160,000. And so, you know, this can be as big a priority as retirement, at least during the season that you're raising kids. So the best way to save for college is what's known as a Section 529 plan. That just refers to the Internal Revenue Code section number 529. If you go to savingforcollege.com, you'll find a lot of information there. But there's all kinds of benefits to a Section 529 plan. Multiple family members and even friends can contribute. It's transferable to another family member. So if you have a child that doesn't need all the money or maybe gets a scholarship, it can be transferred to their child or back to you if you want to go to school, or a cousin or whatever. Has to be a relative closer than a first cousin. In some states, there's a state income tax deduction for your contributions to the plan. That's not true in Kentucky, sadly. Not sure why they haven't got on board with that, but you don't get a Kentucky state income tax deduction for the money you put into a Section 529 plan in Kentucky. But the real advantage is that the funds grow tax-free. So all the gains and growth that we just looked at in the time value of money, that all grows tax-free. And as long as you take it out and use it for college, you'll never pay tax on it. If you do get a scholarship and don't need the money, I mentioned you could pass it on to a relative, but you can also get it back. There's no penalty. You have to pay the tax, but there's no penalty. And it can be used for tuition, room, board, or books. So every state has their own plan, and because Kentucky doesn't have a state income tax deduction, it kind of removes the incentive to use Kentucky's plan, in my opinion. So you may find a plan in another state that has a company you're more familiar with and you want to use them, that's fine. So. So, I mean, student loan debt is a tough one. I'm sure there's many people in here who have it, and I had some. The only thing that I would say is it seems like sometimes as Christians we're not just counting the cost and realizing the implications and consequences of that kind of debt. It is certainly better debt than other kinds of debt, but all the Bible's warnings about debt would apply to student loan debt just the same as any other kind of debt. Again, it's an investment, and I know the intention is that you'll earn more money over your working career than you ever would have by not going to college, and you'll come out ahead. And sometimes that works out, sometimes it doesn't, or sometimes it doesn't work out right away. And finding a job that will meet your needs and pay your student loan debt back right away is not automatic. So, if you're going to incur that kind of debt, just do it soberly and carefully and prayerfully, and realize there's going to be consequences, so, like there is with any debt. So, all right, retirement. The key is starting early to take advantage of that compounding interest over time. If you work for an employer and they have any kind of retirement plan where they match a contribution, totally encourage you to take advantage of that. You can't afford not to, actually. I mean, at Sovereign Grace, if we put in 3%, they'll add another 3% for a total of 6. So I'm instantly getting a 100% return on my investment. So you can't afford not to do that. But not everybody has that opportunity, I understand. So. And when it comes to retirement, there's two main ways to save tax-wise. There's the Roth tax basis, named for Senator Roth from Delaware. And so for most people, the Roth option is the way to go. And if you can save this way, it's tax advantageous. This says Roth IRA. That's an individual retirement account. I may lose you here, but your employer may let you invest to a 401k or a 403b on the Roth tax basis. You'd have to ask. It's up to the employer and the retirement company whether they can accommodate that. But if you save on the Roth basis, either in an IRA or in a 401k, it's tax-free growth, so all those gains and compounding interest over the years are tax-free, and you withdraw it tax-free at retirement age. What you don't get is a tax deduction now for what you contribute. But that's okay. I'd rather have I pay tax on a little to avoid paying tax on a lot later. So in the example we showed at 8%, $172,000, you'd pay tax on $35,000, but on the $137,000 of growth and gains, you would not pay tax. So it's a no-brainer when you think of it that way. The traditional IRA, it's tax-deferred growth. You delay paying the tax. But when you do take the money out at retirement age, you pay tax on it then. The good news is you get a tax deduction now when you contribute to the IRA or 401k. So go Roth if you can. Now, what does retirement mean for the Christian? That's a big question that I don't know how to answer fully, but it's not the American worldly dream of retiring rich and playing golf every day and picking up seashells on the beach. I think the Lord wants us to be productive and fruitful and serving for as long as we can, for as long as He allows. That may mean working for money. It may not mean working for money. But at some point, you know, our bodies are going to break down and our minds will start to lose their capacity, and we just won't be able to do what we used to do. And if we can continue to work, maybe we have to work less or for less money. So there's some eventuality that we're going to stop being able to provide for ourselves at a certain age. And so saving for retirement makes up that difference. All right, well, we're going to do a real quick investing 101 here. This is going to be very basic, but hopefully points you in the right direction. And let me recommend a book. This is Sound Mind Investing, Austin Pryor. It's actually based right here in Louisville. But it's taken from 2 Timothy 1:7, "For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power, love, and a sound mind." That's very good, biblical, straightforward. Our daughter Emily went through it for a high school homeschooling class just on her own study. So that's an option for you. All right, so there's two main ways to invest, and I learned this from Austin Pryor. A is investing as a lender. So basically, you're lending money to somebody, and they're agreeing to pay that money back plus some interest over time. This is also known as fixed income. And this generally is a more stable and a safer and more conservative way to invest, but your returns are going to be limited. You know, in investing, there's a risk, a return relationship, and you know, the greater the risk, the greater the return, and vice versa. So these would be a savings account. That's an example of investing as a lender. You're lending your money to the bank. They're keeping it, paying you some interest, and giving it back to you when you ask for it. A money market account, a CD, all these are examples of investing as a lender that are relatively safe and secure and stable. And with most banks, our money's even insured up to $250,000 per bank. Bonds are also a form of investing as a lender. A bond is basically an IOU. Could be from a company or a government or even a church. A church can issue bonds. The church that Brian and I came from in Maryland, when we were looking at the financing for the construction of the second phase, we had a company in, and this is what they did. They issued bonds through the church. And we didn't choose that route, but it's not limited to just companies or governments. So the risk with buying a bond is the ability of the bond issuer to pay it back. I mean, it's true with lending anybody money. That's the risk, is can they pay it back? Will they pay it back? There's also a relationship between interest rates and bond values. So as interest rates go up, bond values go down, and vice versa. So you can lose money buying a bond if you need to sell it before it matures. It could decrease in value if interest rates go up. But it's fairly safe. The other primary way to invest is investing as an owner. This is what's known as equities or stocks. This is where you have an ownership stake in a company. This is generally more volatile. It's riskier. It's more aggressive. But there's a higher potential return. So a share of stock represents a fraction of ownership in a business, also known as equity. The hope is that the company grows and the value of the stock increases. Plus, dividends are usually earned, which are the distributions of some of the profits to the shareholders. So by buying stock, we can benefit in two ways: dividend income and then appreciation or growth in the value of the stock. And for most people, mutual funds are probably the preferred way to own stock as opposed to owning individual stock, but it depends. My father-in-law, he doesn't have any mutual funds. He owns only individual stocks, so he likes to pick companies to invest in and not blocks of companies that a mutual fund would invest in. I have a few individual stocks, not many, mostly mutual funds. So what's a mutual fund? Well, it's the best way to assemble a well-balanced, diversified portfolio of securities. That's an Austin Pryor quote. And the easiest way to understand a mutual fund is to think of it as a big pool of money. My plain English definition is that it's, number one, a big pool of money. Number two, collected from lots of individual investors. Three, managed by a full-time professional investment manager. And four, the manager invests it according to specific guidelines. When you put money in a mutual fund, you're pooling your money with other investors in order to gain advantages normally available only to the wealthiest investors. So it would be like all 25 of us in this room, let's say, agreed to put up $1,000 each and appoint somebody to be the manager, and we all agree to pay the expenses associated with making the investments, and we decide on a certain type of investment to concentrate on, like maybe small companies that have a lot of potential for growth, and the fund manager would go buy stocks in those companies. We'd pull our money together, take advantage of the numbers, and our expenses would be better, and by pulling our money together, we could make it go further and hopefully come out ahead. So a mutual fund is a generic term. It could have stocks or bonds or both. Could have real estate, could have cash. So the mutual fund is just the structure. It's not the type of investment, really. One reason people don't like mutual funds is because of the costs and expenses associated with them. Sometimes there's commissions, there's fees, and those just slow down the rate of return. They're like a drag on your growth over time. So the higher the cost, the slower the growth. So you want to look for companies that have no commissions and small expenses. The big companies like Vanguard or Fidelity will typically have no commissions and low fees. So you have the best chance at the best gains. Well, I thought we'd look at a real life example. The next page is a fact sheet for a real mutual fund. I mentioned Vanguard. Vanguard is a very good company. They have low expenses, no commissions, a wide choice of funds. So this is the Vanguard 500 Index. It's a mutual fund, and it's tied to the S&P 500 index. So basically, as well as the top 500 companies in America do, that's how well you're going to do. And if you look over on the right under fund facts, the asset class is domestic stock, so it's U.S. companies versus international. It means it's stock, so that's an equity kind of investment. We're investing as an owner as opposed to a lender. The category is large blend, so these are big companies. These are companies with a lot of capital. And the blend means it's kind of a cross between what they call a value stock and a growth stock. The expense ratio is very low. It's 0.17%. So basically, you're going to get the entire gain out of the S&P 500 index minus 0.17%. Not bad. I mean, most funds probably have a half a percent to a full percent, or sometimes even more as the fee. So Vanguard has some of the lowest fees around. If you look at the risk potential, they rate it 4 out of 5 on the risky scale. So that's because it's stocks, and stocks can lose their value. Back in 2009, I think it was, what the stock market lost half its value. So you have to be willing to ride out the ups and downs. And the longer you have to do that, the more likely you are to come out ahead. So if you need the money in a few months or a few years, you don't want to invest it in stocks. You can't afford the risk of losing it. So if you look at that chart on the bottom left, on the far right, it's probably hard to read, but since inception, on August 31, 1976, 11.05%. And that's with, you know, the big downturn back in 2009. So I would take 11% a year for 40 years any day. So, and even for 10 years, it's done 8%. So that little line graph on the bottom right there, if you'd invested $10,000 10 years ago, you'd have over $20,000 now. So at 8%, you double your money every 10 years or so. So a lot of potential here. And this is the kind of thing that, you know, if you have a new job and you're meeting with the HR people and they give you a form and you have to pick a fund, you know, this is the kind of information you're going to be presented with, so hopefully this will help you a little bit. The next page is One other kind of mutual fund, it's become more and more popular. This is a sheet from Guidestone Financial Services. That's a company that's associated with the Southern Baptist Convention. And Sovereign Grace Churches has an agreement with Guidestone so all of our churches can participate in their retirement plan. And they're very good too. They've won lots of awards for small, in the small company category. So if you don't want to deal with any of this, basically, and you want a one-stop shop and just want to make one decision and forget about it, as far as your retirement savings, a date target fund is an option. So basically, you pick the approximate age you need the retirement income, and they gear a fund towards that date automatically. It'll start out more aggressive, riskier, heavier in stocks in the beginning. And as time goes on, it becomes more and more conservative, more and more concentrated in fixed income or bonds. So you can see the progression there on that, those pie charts at the top. At 40 years before retirement, when you start out, it's all stocks. And it gradually changes every 5 years or 10 years. So at retirement, it's about 50-50, it looks like. So they'll do this for you automatically. You don't have to think about it. And again, if you just want to make a decision and not worry about it for the next 40 years, this is an option for you.
When it says all stocks here, that 40-year retirement one,
mm-hmm.
that can be mutual funds too, right? Not just like individual
stocks. Correct, yes. Guidestone has their own mutual funds. But it would be a mutual fund that's made up only of stocks. But it could be 100 different companies that make up that mutual fund. Yeah. So this is the basic rule of thumb that, you know, you start off aggressive, a little more willing to tolerate the risk, accept the ups and downs of the market that are going to happen because you have more time to ride it out. And then the closer you get to retirement, the more conservative and safer you get to preserve your investments. All right, well, in closing, I don't want us to leave here mostly thinking about stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. I'd rather we leave here thinking about eternity, which is what stewardship is really all about. And this is a quote from the Treasure Principle. If we give instead of keep, if we invest in the eternal instead of in the temporal, we store up treasures in heaven that will never stop paying dividends. Whatever treasures we store up on earth will be left behind when we leave. Whatever treasures we store up in heaven will be waiting for us when we arrive. Financial planners tell us, when it comes to your money, don't think just 3 months or 3 years. Think 30 years ahead. Christ, the ultimate investment counselor, takes it further. He says, don't ask how much your investment would be paying off in just 30 years. Ask how it will be paying off in 30 million years. So that's what I get excited about. I mean, I enjoy investing. I enjoy learning about these things, teaching these things. But I get excited about the gospel being advanced and the church being built and the Leadership Development Fund kicking off here and the Building Fund kicking off here. That's what has the true eternal rewards that we'll never lose. Jim Elliot, who was the missionary killed in Ecuador in the 50s, put it this way, he is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. Amen.